humanity would benefit from a vegan world because the natural world is vegan. Veganism is so much more than a diet. It is a non-exploitative relationship to life. And we are the only animals on the planet that are exploiting, domesticating, and controlling other beings for our use. When that is no longer a concern, we have access to a much deeper, much more informed body of wisdom that's available through the interconnectedness of all life on the planet.
Welcome, listeners. I'm glad you are here.
Welcome to the Live Vegan Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Leahy, and this is a podcast featuring inspirational leaders in the animal rights community. We are joined by co-host and legionnaire of logic, Ben Loa. What up, Ben?
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
I'm doing great, as always.
I'm excited. We actually, well, what are we, 60, 70 episodes in? And 70. You think after, what's that?
70. This is number 70.
Is this 70? Okay, perfect. Sorry. Maybe I should know that. And you'd think after a while we'd run out of things to talk about, but I'm excited because we do have a subject matter today that we've never really discussed. I mean, you and I, between us, may have, but we haven't had someone on to talk about it. So this should be good.
Well, yeah, it comes up often, I think, in debate, and especially when people accuse us of being on moral high horses. Have you ever heard that?
Yeah. So, vegans don't ride horses.
I think it would be funny if someone said that while sitting on top of an actual horse and then like made that excuse. I don't know. So, all right, we're going to talk about horses amongst other types of exploitation, and we are going to decide whether it's ethical or unethical. And we're going to talk with Ren Hurst, who is a former professional horse trainer and hoof care specialist with 20 years experience in the industry. After a profound shift in awareness, she left her successful career to speak up for animals and spread awareness about the rampant exploitation present not only in our relationship to horses, but to all domesticated animals. Ren's journey with horses is shared in her first book, Riding on the Power of Others, A Horsewoman's Path to Unconditional Love, and she is currently working on her next book, Animal Kin, Restoring Connection to Wild Wisdom, a philosophical and practical guide for moving out of exploitation and into unconditional love in relationship to animals and beyond. Currently, you can find Ren teaching her body of work, Sanctuary 13, at patreon.com/rendermewild. Ren, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin and Ben. I'm honored to be here with you tonight.
All right. So just in case there's, you know, somebody that isn't familiar with your story, before we get into the real hard hitting questions, could you maybe, now I'm looking for a Cole's Notes version, so not, you know, you don't have to read your entire book, but tell us about your background, where you came from, your relationship with horses, and then maybe just touch on, you know, where that revelation came from about how you needed to change what you were doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'll definitely let people read the book for the whole story. But I grew up in Texas. I grew up in horse country. So I grew up around horses, have loved horses my whole life. Grew up going to rodeos and all the things you do when you're from that background. And when I was a young adolescent, preteen, I got my first horse and, you know, started riding pretty regularly and got into training once I was a teenager. That moved into taking it more seriously and getting into the professional world in that regard as I moved into college. Paid for most of my college from buying, selling, training horses. And, you know, it just continued to evolve up the various levels of fine-tuning what that looked like and jumping on board with the latest techniques and methodologies. And then it turned into holistic horse care and hoof care specialty and being a practitioner of that work. And it kept growing because I had a really high standard of excellence for who I wanted to be and how effective I was at what I did. And so I kept looking for who was considered the best in the industry in these various areas that I was interested in. And so I just kept learning and kept growing and kept changing because I wanted to be the best. And ultimately, that led me to a man named Alexander Nevzorov out of Russia. And I watched a film called The Path of the Horse that exhibited him in the film. And I saw him doing things that I had only heard of were possible in theory. And because of the vast amount of experience I had, what I watched him do resonated very deeply as, this is legitimate, this is an integrity, this is authentic, and I want to be able to do that. And so I started implementing his work with the horses in my care, specifically a stallion that I had rescued that had no previous training and was what most people would consider a relatively dangerous animal to work with, especially without a lot of control. And so this form of horsemanship was completely devoid of any sort of coercion or manipulation. It was all very relationship based. It wasn't training. And the things that were achieved through that relationship launched me into a whole new paradigm of what's possible between us and animals when we aren't exploiting them. And it just kind of shattered my reality. And so there's a whole lot of layers to that and a whole lot of specifics, but that's kind of in a nutshell how I got from point A to point B.
Okay, so you mentioned exploitation. Just to be clear, you're saying that riding a horse is a form of exploitation, is that right?
Without a doubt.
So how can we, let's explore that a little. Like, what is wrong, ethically speaking, with, say, a mutually beneficial symbiotic relationship between animals and humans?
Well, let's just take it out of the context of right and wrong and look at exploitation for what it is, which is the use of someone or in order to derive benefit from. So you cannot ride a horse without first conditioning them to be ridden. There's just no way to do that. There's no such thing as a relationship between horse and man where it looks like a wild horse coming up to a human and being like, hey, please climb on top of me. I really want that. So the only way we have access to the horse's back is by first capturing them, putting them in captivity, and then putting them through a conditioning process we call domestication, so that we have enough influence over their lives to be able to climb on top of them. And because of their captive dependency, there's no way to do that without exploitation being involved. The very nature of domestication is exploitation by definition of the word.
Okay, so what's that process like? We hear the term broken. You know, a horse has to be sure. Broken first. Is that accurate? Like, do they have to be broken necessarily? And what does that mean? And like, what does it take to do that?
It depends. There's a lot of shades of what that looks like. On the more extreme scales, or the more extreme ends of the scale, you could look at the more obvious, like breaking, which is you physically just dominate the animal and jump on their back and ride them until they submit. And then once the submission has occurred, you've got a pretty compliant animal that knows that they've been broken. Or you could step into the much more insidiously harmful paradigm of breaking horses, which a lot of women dominate now, where it's more energetic in that due to the enormous amount of influence we have over these captive dependents, we can just shift our energy and control them and manipulate them and influence them. And not only that, we can do it with huge amounts of adoration, affection, kindness, care, consideration, and then take advantage of the fact that they are captive dependents. And that can look very alluring, and which is why so many people don't believe that it's exploitation, because you genuinely care about the animal and you're not intending to harm them. But not very many people are taking into consideration that the only reason you're able to do that is because you've got them in captivity.
So it's not the harm per se. It's like in philosophy, we talk about utilitarianism versus deontology and like the use of someone. No matter how nicely you treat them, if you're using them as a means to your end, it's still wrong. Is that?
Well, I would say it's still harmful, because it may not be. I mean, it is physically harmful to ride a horse, but that is negligible and arguable to a grand scale. I mean, it really just depends on how you're riding, because it is possible to ride a horse without physically harming them. It's just not what people typically think of as riding. Your typical ride is going to involve you being on the horse for more than 10 minutes and making them do things they don't necessarily want to do. And that is always going to lead into some physical harm on various levels. But the harm I'm speaking to is psychological, emotional, not only for the horse, but for the person conducting the exploitation, in that it creates emotional dependency with a captive dependent, which is always abusive.
Okay, but don't horses like to be ridden? They love running around, and we hear this argument here all the time. If you have a dog companion, you got to take your dog for a walk. So if you have a horse companion, don't you have to jump on their back and take them for some exercise?
The thing that about that argument just that is so crazy is that, for one, horses don't start that conversation. They don't start the conversation of, hey, will you please climb on top of me? Now, yes, they can absolutely be conditioned to a place where not only do they accept being ridden, but they look forward to it if that is the best thing they have to look forward to. And if it's the only way they get to spend time with the person they care about, if it's the only way they get to get out of their paddock or their area, there's so many reasons that a horse could seemingly enjoy being ridden. However, if you replace the riding with an authentically loving, unconditional relationship in which all of the horse's needs are still being met, no horse would ever agree to be being ridden, because it's not good or fun for them when their needs are being met in other, more loving ways.
So would this kind of be like a Stockholm syndrome? That they become captive, and then they become dependent on their captor. And then what people see as you know, a relationship and admiration, like you said, is just because it was conditioned into them?
Yeah, for the most part, yes. But it goes deeper than that. Most people don't recognize the subtlest form of no from their horse or their animals in general, because they're not looking for it. They're looking for the yes. So most people think a horse's no looks like getting bucked off or getting kicked or getting bitten. But the subtlest form of no is anything that's not an obvious yes. And for anybody that's ever been taken advantage of, ever been abused, ever had their boundaries violated, you know what the subtlest no looks like. And it is just not offering consent. As horse owners, those people aren't looking for that no. They're not only looking for the yes, they're looking for how they can turn a no into a yes. That's what training is. And so, yeah, there's some Stockholm syndrome going on there, but mostly it's just people taking advantage of the situation.
Or do you think it's possible to get consent at all? Like actual consent? I guess I'm thinking about the definition of consent. Like, what is that truly? It seems to me that it'd be defined as you need an adult human only to get consent, truly get consent. But do you think animals can consent? Because I don't know. I think about my dog, who is a rescue dog. You know, she's from South Korea, and oftentimes I have to tell her what to do because it's for her good. Like I have to make that call, and she does not want to do it. Like, you know, she has to go to the vet. She has to get groomed. If it was up to her, her hair would be, you know, all in her eyes, and she would never get a haircut. So I just wonder, like, how do we deal with these situations where we can't really ever truly get consent from animals? Or do you think we can? And I'm just not
looking. There's a few ways to answer all of that. So for one, as their guardians, we're responsible for their basic needs and their care and their well-being and their safety. Where you draw the line on that just depends on each individual person's ability and awareness. So for me, that looks like I don't control anything in my animals' lives that isn't necessary for their absolute undeniable care, safety, and well-being. There are a lot of things that we do with animals that we think are necessary for their well-being, but it's questionable. And usually it's related to our own sense of comfort and our own desires. And that's where a lot of vegans really struggle with the exploitative nature of having pets and all forms of training. But to go back and answer your question about consent, dependents cannot offer consent for their use, or they can't consent to an equal relationship. We don't need our dependents' consent to take care of them, because of the nature of their dependency, they are kind of like an extension of ourselves. So when it comes to taking care of them, feeding them, getting them to the vet, things like that, we don't need consent for those things. What we would need consent for is the things we do with them for fun, for relationship, whatever. And the fact is captive permanent dependents cannot offer consent for things like that. So our job as guardians is to take care of them and to love them, much like you would relate to conscious parenting rather than the way we interact with animals.
So what about dressing your dog up with a Halloween costume and taking a picture?
Definitely no.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I've thought about that. And this is something that even a lot of vegans struggle with is, yeah. You know, when my, I used to have a dog companion, and I used to put a treat on her nose and she would hold it there, and I'd show people like, look, she'll wait until I snap my fingers, she'll throw it up in there and she'll catch it. And to me, it was like, oh, look, I'm so proud of her. But then, you know, after a while I realized, I'm like, I'm doing this solely for my entertainment, for my friend's entertainment. And I'm making this dog do this. But what about something simple like sit, shake a paw, you know, cause I see vegans do it all the time. And it's just like, should I, you know, should to give them a treat? Should they have to perform?
Not in my opinion. No, not at all. And the thing is it's all exploitation. And I think this is where the root of so much of the contention within the vegan community exists. There is an incongruence happening with so many vegans in their day-to-day lives with these domesticated animals that is being, you know, communicated when they have these strong messages of right and wrong and should or should not. You have to have congruence if you want to be really effective in your advocacy for these animals.
And I like that you made the connection to parenting too, because I'm a father, Kevin's a father, and we wouldn't make our kids do tricks before we, you know, gave them a cookie.
And if you can recognize that could be the only question you ever have to ask yourself again in regards to how you relate to the animals in your care. Would I do this with my child?
Yeah, perfect.
I guess the only difference then is, like, I can ask my daughter, do you want to dress up for Halloween? You know, and she can say yes. And then it goes back to that very definition of consent. It's like, can she really consent and know what she's getting into? Because she's still just a 5-year-old kid at this point. So I don't know. I wonder about, like, I think the line is maybe discipline versus entertainment, right? So like,
there's a difference in her ability to consent and the animals. Your daughter is a human being that is being developed to become emotionally mature and then go out and have an independent life from you. The animals are not. They are permanent captive dependents. They're never going to be emotionally mature and autonomous. They're never going to have total sovereignty over their lives. They do not have access to the outside world. There's such a broad difference between what they're able to say yes to and what a human child that has access to so much more can.
Okay, I want to throw another excuse at you. So
another one
we hear a lot is, and maybe this is a couple in one, but it's their job, right? It's what they were bred to do. They wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for that job. And I have to go to work, right? So I have to earn my keep. So for them to have this life that I'm giving them, then why can't they just have a job?
Because they're permanent captive dependents, and dependents can't be held to that level of responsibility.
So it'd be like saying, because we exploit humans in this capitalistic world, why can't we exploit animals? That is, Ben, is that sort of the excuse you're asking?
Yeah, you know what, I hear it all the time, and it comes up a lot. Well, we had Adam Sturr on, who they're doing the protests against the horse-drawn carriages in Niagara on the Lake, and that's an excuse that they come up with a lot too. It's like, oh, it's their job, right? That's what they're bred for, and I have to go to work, so why shouldn't this horse, because of this capitalist system that we create. Sorry?
But the idea that I have to go to work is a story. Well, no, you don't. You can choose a totally alternative lifestyle and do all sorts of different things. You can do something you love. You don't have to do anything. And the thing is someone of equal power cannot be exploited. And that's where people are. That's the harm of exploiting others. We only exploit others when we ourselves feel exploited in some way. And we deny ourselves our power to decide what kind of life we're going to live. So anybody with that story of, oh, well, I'm exploited, I have to have a job, so why shouldn't they, is just in total denial of the power they have to create their life.
Are we equal, like morally equivalent to animals, you think?
What do you mean by that?
Well, I guess the question would be, like, I always come at it from a philosophical perspective. If we had to kill a horse or a human, should we flip a coin?
Oh, in that regard, I think yes, but I do believe that morality is subjective. So I try to come at this from a more objective standpoint of either it's exploitation or it's not.
Right. It's either yes or it's no. Okay. So I'd say there's like degrees though. No, maybe not.
I don't know. I mean, for me, that's the only black and white in any of this. It's either you're exploiting, you're either using someone to benefit from them and abusing power to do so, or you're not.
Yeah. I think the message of equality is one that's not mainstream, you know, and that's why it seems like it's totally fine to ride on a horse. Like, obviously, humans believe that humans are superior because it's easier for us to think that. And I, you know, obviously think that to whatever degree, depending on which animal we're talking about. I don't think we should flip a coin if it's a human life versus a mosquito, or a snail, or, you know, like, I don't know where we should flip a coin, but I do think that there's something special about humans where they do get more moral worth. And I might just be wrong about that. And because I think that I'm not saying exploitation is okay. But I see the point of using animal, not using, sorry, wrong word. I guess there's no way out of this.
But you're saying that because you're a human.
Yeah.
If you were a horse, you wouldn't be saying the same thing. You wouldn't be saying that humans, you know, should have more morality because of whatever, intelligence or anything.
Well, I just think that because we do have this caretaker role, that maybe it's okay for them to like ask for something in return. That's all I'm trying to say. And I don't know that that's right, but kind of like a job. And so in the way that Ben was saying before, not for entertainment necessarily, but something that makes, our lives okay in this world, in this capitalistic world. Like you said before, we don't have to work. I kind of feel like we do have to, like, there's no escape. We're like, we live in a world where we have to pay rent, we have to work for food. And so obviously the animals don't have to work, but if I'm providing them with lots of resources, wouldn't it be okay to ask for something in return?
Well, we have to work, but we don't have to work to the point that we are like resentful about it, which is the only place that, well, I work, they should have to work, would ever come from. There are plenty of people doing work that they love that are contributing to society and that aren't going to then turn to an animal and be like, I'm so happy, you should have to be happy too. That's not where that argument comes from. So let's be clear on that first. But then the fact that we force them into our lives, absolutely, we cannot assume that that gives us the right to define their existence or assume that we know what their purpose is beyond their purpose being who they are. And I think that that is kind of like the underlying foundation of violence.
And again, if they were, if it was human, Kevin, we would, like, that question would not come up. We wouldn't say, "Oh, I gave someone a place to live, you know, or I let somebody, you know, stay with me. Therefore, I can make them do whatever I want.
Or like, I
they
can
have to do things for me." Or yeah, or children. So
well, actually, no, that's that would be my point. Like, I ask my daughter to make the bed. You know, that's okay to some extent. That's all. I don't know. Like, where's
that's
the
a
line?
Teaching point.
Is it a teaching point? I feel like she yeah. should do her roles and responsibilities. That's what chores are. Again, it's the difference between humans and animals. I get it. But if we go down to, like, say, a 2-year-old, 3-year-old kid, where there is an equivalent factor in terms of being dependent, then I think, I don't know. I don't know where. I just feel like some degree might be okay.
But that child, when they grow up, can move out.
And you can educate your children without reward systems of reward and punishment. If you lead by example and you're an authentic representation of what they need and the love they deserve, they're going to cooperate with you. Same is true for animals. And that's the part of the story that most people haven't experienced, because our culture is so domesticated, both human culture and then how we relate and experience animals. Very few people know what it's like to be in relationship, in an undomesticated relationship, to children or animals. But that work is being done in the world, and there are people talking about it, and there are ways to teach and raise children without expectations of them.
Okay, I want to discuss something that for some people is a little controversial, although I can't exactly see why, but you have a sanctuary, okay? And there are some sanctuaries that I'm aware of that actually offer horseback riding. So everybody, all the residents that are there are all rescues. They might have rescued cows, rescued pig, rescued chickens, rescued horses, and then offer horseback riding on these horses that came as horseback riding horses. And the argument I've heard is, well, they do that because it brings people to the sanctuary to take horseback riding lessons, and then they learn about all these other animals, and it's a way to educate them about the horrors of farm animals. Just wondering your take on that.
My take on that is exploiting rescued animals to support a personal agenda. And while I have a sanctuary, I am constantly growing and learning and coming more into the full integrity of the purity of what this work is I teach. And I don't have a sanctuary. I provide sanctuary to the animals in my care. And I've given up every modern convenience you can think of at some point in order to do it, including walk away from my career. And I don't have, like, I don't have plumbing or any sort of modern conveniences other than this awesome internet connection because of where I happen to live. But I had to walk away from not just my career, but from having your typical sanctuary, because that is still exploitation. And the deeper my practice with these animals went, and the deeper my understanding of this work became, and the deeper my connection became to the truth of this and my experience with these animals, I kept having to peel off these much subtler layers of exploitation into the point where, you know, if you're using an animal, not only is it exploitation, but it is keeping you from your own authentic power. And I think that is the real harm that is caused through exploitation, because, you know, animals in a Stockholm syndrome state of mind, or in a state of learned helplessness, they don't really know they're being abused, so they can handle it. We're the ones that are really giving something up through our exploitation of others. And most people aren't aware of that. And that's why they spend their days complaining about having a job and things of that nature.
Okay, I just read online today that in 2018, more animals were slaughtered for food than ever before. And it keeps going up, and we're expecting it to go up. And that was just in North America. I know worldwide it's the same. So my question would be, how do you think we should deal with Carnis, like the mainstream message, and in this regard, in terms of horseback riding is unethical? Do you think that there's a potential for a lashback to dismiss us as extremists, and therefore we shouldn't listen to that at all, and then status quo continues?
Absolutely, but especially if we use words like unethical and right and wrong and should. I think that the best way to inspire change is to be the change and be the example. And I don't mean by changing surface level behaviors. I mean by coming into full alignment with non-exploitation, which is what I believe veganism actually is. It's not a diet. It's not whether or not we're being cruel. It is non-exploitation in relationship to animals. And there are very few vegans that are willing to live in the integrity of that, from what my experience has been in this circle for the last 5 or 6 years. But I think that's how you really inspire and affect change. I don't have people tell me this is extreme when I'm being considerate of where they are and meeting them where they're at. And, you know, when the idea is presented in that way, yeah, there's a ton of kickback and a ton of, oh my God, you're a purist and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I'm not making anyone wrong. I'm just calling it what it is. It's either exploitation or it's not. And all you have to do is pick up a dictionary to figure that one out. But the people that I hear from all over the world on a daily basis that have stopped riding their horses as a result of what I'm doing and what I'm saying, because I'm holding myself to the same standard of everything I'm saying on a daily basis, has been very effective. And it's because I'm not trying to change anyone. All I'm trying to do is speak up for what I believe in and be the example of that. And that is enormously effective.
Do you, a lot of the, I guess the horseback riding that is, you know, most prominent, that we know the most of, is racing. I mean, Sports Illustrated had their top, I think this was a few years ago, had their top 100 athletes of all time. And I think it was like 19 or 20 was a horse. Secretariat was one of the best athletes of all time. And this was essentially a slave that was forced to do something. Do you have much knowledge? I'm sure you know a little bit about that industry and what it's like. Yeah. I mean, in Ontario, where Kevin and I live, our government just gave $10 million to the horse racing industry to prop it up and to help it profit while they cut education. So what can you tell us about that industry?
I mean, it's horrific. I have an off the track thoroughbred in my care. I have an enormous range of experience in the industry. So I've been on the track. I've worked on a lot of racehorses. I've fixed a lot of their feet. I've trained some. So, I mean, it's the same as the rest of it. It's definitely not any worse than any other genre of horse activity, but it's a horrific industry. It's very, very abusive.
But it's not like they're not more abusive than others. I mean, we hear stories of getting pumped full of steroids and stuff. Is that just kind of myth, or is there...
It's horrible. I mean, it doesn't matter where you look. There's really bad stuff going on.
I guess whenever there's money to be made and animals are in the mix, there's going to be a lot of suffering.
Yeah. I mean, the racehorse industry is more accessible to more people, I guess. But I mean, there's all sorts of different, there's cutting horses, and there's, you know, the Tennessee Walkers that get their hooves weighted down so that they have the big gates. There's all sorts of horrific activities within each of these various ways and of tradition of being with horses, that they're all brutal. And, you know, they've been seemingly evolving to be more conscious and gentler and kinder, but honestly, it only looks less abusive on the surface than it used to. It's still psychological warfare. The nicer you are to the animal, but still enslaving them.
What about like breaking, like when they break their legs? Like we're taught as kids that, you know, when a horse, they break their legs either on the track or somewhere else, that's it. They have to be put down.
Yeah. That's the common practice for how to deal with that, 'cause it's extremely expensive to care for a horse appropriately long enough for a leg to heal.
It just comes down to money.
Well, basically, and it's an awful existence for a horse to heal a broken leg just because of so much of their weight is displaced. But, you know, it's not just the racing industry that happens. That happens in almost all of the sports. I mean, you could look into 3-day eventing, and you could look into any rodeo. You're going to see broken legs and broken limbs.
All right, so that was all entertainment that you just mentioned there. I wanted to ask about something that is, you know, as we define it now, as a society, we define it as necessary. And I know that's going to be up for debate. But, like, what about cops on horseback who have a significant advantage over dealing with crowds and when dealing with crowds? What do you recommend they do instead? And also, I'm thinking of canine dogs, police dogs, who right. sniff out drugs or bombs or, you know, help in so many different ways.
Or we could piss off even more people and start talking about animal assisted therapy. But,
yeah, let's do that.
Sure.
My quick answer to that is that it's primitive and it's lazy. We have access to more. We have the ability to develop technology that could far surpass that. We could become the kind of humans that do not need to rely on the exploitation of other beings. It's like, why are we the only animals on this planet that are so disconnected from each other that we have to enslave one another to get things done? It's not the natural order of things. And there's a much vaster wisdom available to us, but we have to stop exploiting in order to access it. So while those things are needed, this is why I think it's so important to not get into the right and wrong area of this. Some of those things are necessary until they're not, just because that's where we're at right now. And that really sucks. And it's really unfortunate for the animals and the others that, you know, are going to have to experience the harmful consequences of such. But more of us need to be developing and working on the solutions to those things rather than looking at them and being like, that's wrong. We've got to be able to replace it with something better if we expect people to give it up.
I like that. That's a very pragmatic look at it, because it's easy to say, like, it's simple. Like, for whatever reason, you shouldn't have to use someone, keep them captive, use them against their will without their consent to make your life better or pleasurable in any way. But you're right. Let's give them an alternative, just like we do with, you know, with plant-based meats. You know, stop eating burgers. We've now come up with other solutions. You know, it's not just stop doing it and figure it out yourself. So I like that that perspective. So okay, let's say you get your way, you convince everyone. You're like, everyone's, you know what? Okay, let's stop using non-human animals for our benefit or our pleasure. So we could talk specifically about horses or just companion animals in general. What do we do then? Do we just stop breeding them? Do these beings become extinct?
Well, I hope so. So I already got my way. I stopped exploiting animals, and unfortunately, that left me with 29 in my care because I was a professional animal exploiter. And so that part kind of sucks. And that's why I live in a 96 square foot shack in the middle of nowhere and do whatever I can to take care of them. But for most people who weren't totally engulfed in the industry the way that I was, the other side of this is just amazing. I mean, it's so beautiful and it's so worthy, and it would have to be. Otherwise, people like me making six figures in an exploitative career would have never walked away from it. There's just no, I don't have a moral obligation to do the right thing. I have come across a deeper truth that is motivating me and inspiring me to continue down this path. And the connection I feel with myself, the animals in my care, the world around me, life in general, is so much more profound than that which I had access to exploiting others. And, you know, you can look back into my history. I could do anything I wanted to on the back of a horse. It was amazing. I loved it. That's what I believed connection and love looked like back then. And I've just tapped into something infinitely more fulfilling. And that's what's on the other side of it. And yes, I do hope that eventually domestication fizzles out. And I just don't think that needs to be part of an evolved human society.
So you mentioned that you started on this journey through your relationship with horses, and then you eventually noticed that had all these other relationships with other animals that you then became aware of. What are some of the relationships that not everyone is necessarily thinking about that you think we should be aware of, that we should be thinking about, because it is still exploitation? Like, what are some of the lesser known ones?
Yeah, my next book focuses on dogs for that very reason, because I think that's going to be the most relatable and the most accessible domesticated being in most households. And just kind of taking people through my journey undomesticating my dogs, because that's what I did, is I undomesticated the horses in my care. And what that means is basically you remove all forms of exploitation and shift the relationship from one of being exploitative to one of being truly unconditionally loving in a guardian capacity, in that I have strong bonds and relationships with these animals, but I am there to care for them because that's my responsibility due to the nature of their captive dependency, instead of me deriving some motivated benefit from it. And the thing that people don't realize is you give up the ease of a surface level benefit, but what you get instead is a benefit that's just so much more fulfilling and more accessible and more, it infiltrates other areas of your life in a very big way. And so this has become my practice. How I am with these animals is my practice of becoming the best version of myself that I can be. It's allowed me to become more emotionally aware and mature than I ever had access to previously. And I think most humans are very disconnected from their emotional awareness. It's like we don't really know what that's for or what it means, so we reach for everything outside of us, including domesticating others and including exploiting others, to derive a specific kind of feeling instead of accessing the feelings that are already within us to guide us in the direction that allows us to live the most purposeful, fulfilling lives. And so the next book really focuses on dogs, but I developed a body of work around this way of being with animals that is a set of 13 practically applied principles of relationship that are 100% equally applicable to any animal, much less other humans, whatever, relationships in general. But obviously my background and experience and expertise is with animals, so I tend to try to stay in that area so that I don't get too far off.
when are you expecting that book to come out? Because that sounds fantastic, and a book that, as far as I know, has a subject matter that's never actually been covered.
Yeah, that's why it's taking so long. I started writing it in December 2015, and I was still very much in a right-wrong mindset, very animal activist-driven. And that would have been a great book, too, but it would not have been in alignment with where I'm at with this now. And so this book has had many evolutions, and I'm on the final rewrite, and I've got the final outline, and I'm plugging away at it, and I expect it to be done pretty soon. And I'm going to publish it myself and hopefully have it out for print. I hesitate to put a date on it, but I'm really gunning to have it available by the end of the summer.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, we'll plug it on our show too, because it's, like I said, that's something I'm not familiar with, a book talking about specifically just the overall exploitation of non-human animals and using them for our pleasure. So that's exciting. Can you tell us about the sanctuary specifically? What's going on, and maybe how can people learn more? Maybe lend their support if there's a way, or get in touch with you.
Yeah, thank you. My idea of sanctuary has evolved tremendously just in the last few years, because when I wrote the first book, that launched me into the vegan atmosphere. And I became a voice for that. And I got invited to a lot of places, and I got to speak and visit a lot of sanctuaries. And I was regularly and consistently disappointed because of what I was seeing and experiencing there. And it's not like I didn't see good things. There's a lot of people doing a lot of good things. But what brought me to veganism was non-exploitation, not a diet. So it was my relationship to horses that made me vegan, not deciding not to eat meat. And that was the part that seemed to be missing everywhere I went, is there were still all these exploitative qualities to the relationships to these animals in sanctuary and the sanctuary itself. It's like the moment you turn a sanctuary into a business, how non-exploitative can it be? And so when I first wrote the first book, I had a sanctuary and I was trying to do things different, and people were coming out there and meeting the animals, and you know, a lot of good things happened, but it was like, this isn't in the integrity of what this is. So I withdrew, and I ended up dissolving the nonprofit and giving up everything and buying a very large piece of land for the animals. That's just our home. It's just our private home. And these animal, I'm responsible for these animals. The public isn't. I mean, obviously I'm the one that brought them into my life. I chose that. So I'm taking responsibility for that now. And yes, many people have helped me and many people continue to help me because they believe in what I'm trying to do. But I'm making it more about the work that I'm making available to people now and what I have to offer as an individual, rather than, oh, please support these animals, which was a huge shift I had to make. That was a really tough layer to peel back and see that that was still happening. It was still like, it was almost as if I didn't believe in myself and this work enough. So I still had to make the story of, oh, the animals need your help, please help us. And everything went to the animals, but it still wasn't really authentic. So my idea of sanctuary now is, you know, be responsible for what you have created and try to share your gifts with the world. And so I created an account on Patreon where I make this body of work that is in this new book available. I'm teaching these principles on a weekly basis on Patreon. And so that's the main way to support my work and the animals in sanctuary. I still have a long way to go. We're 100% reliant on Patreon, and I'm only bringing in about half of what just our basic animal care needs are. And then I have various angel donors in my life that make sure that we keep eating. So the best way to help me is to check out the Patreon account. It's patreon.com/rendermewild. And then when this new book comes out, pick it up. If you've read my first book and you liked it, that is the what. This new book is the how and the why. And I think it's really gonna help a lot of people.
Well, we'll definitely link everything you just said in the show notes so that our listeners can check out your sanctuary and your Patreon. So I know we're out of time. I just wanted to get a little tiny teaser, if you don't mind, from your new book coming out. Obviously, we should not be supporting breeders and buying dogs from breeders. But like, what's the number one thing we do wrong with regards to pet dogs? Or you don't want to say? You don't want to say? It's okay.
I'll think about it. I don't want to put a wrong on it, because shame does never leads to evolution. So,
unethical. Is that better?
I'm going to say the main mistake we make in being in the integrity of the love that we have for our dogs, the one that is consistently made on a daily basis, is not honoring their no. Not only not honoring their no, but not creating a space of invitation for them to say no. And I mean, to a more obvious answer, you have to eliminate training. Systems of reward and punishment are very primitive systems of control and compliance that are not necessary from an authentic leadership standpoint. And so if you're training your dog, you're exploiting them. It's pretty black and white.
I have so many more questions, but we're going to have to wait till the book is out. All right. Well, thank you for joining us, and thank you for getting us to think about these issues, and thank you for your time this evening.
Thank you both so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks, Ren.
All right, Ben, we're back. What'd you think?
That was a great chat. It was like I said before, it was something that we've talked about in passing, and I will say that I agree with her 100%, whether it comes to horses or dogs or any being, human, non-human, whatever. We shouldn't use anybody for anything, even if we benefit, unless it's, you know, a matter of our actual survival and life and death, then there's no moral ground to use anyone for anything. But what I found really interesting was that I wanted to point out was what she gave up. So she came to this realization that what I'm doing is not okay. It doesn't align with my beliefs, my moral beliefs. And she gave up a lot. Like she said, she like to buy this little house, out in the countryside somewhere, and gave up a lot of income because she realized what she was doing was wrong. So, and I know she wouldn't like to use the word wrong, but it's, you know, it goes to show that even if you are, you know, have a monetary gain from something, that, you know, you can still do the right thing. And a lot of people will be like, I wish I could change. And this doesn't even just have to do with veganism. There's a lot of moral things that people just do because they feel like they have to, but she's a perfect example, though, and maybe you don't.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about that interview. I like thinking about these issues because they're sometimes very difficult to distinguish, to discern. Some people might disagree with that and say, well, it's clearly right or clearly wrong. But I think when we start talking about some of these moral issues, it gets harder to distinguish right from wrong. And I think there are degrees. And I try not to let the gray area cloud my judgment on what's black and white. Like, clearly we shouldn't be slaughtering animals for food in this day and age. You know, we shouldn't be racing horses for entertainment in this day and age, things like that. Absolutely. Positively. That's a black and white decision. It's so easy to see. I think as with all issues of morality, there's going to be harder examples to parse out.
Like what though?
Oh, just like with our relationship with dogs. I think there's probably something in the book that...
Yeah, but there's a difference between caring for a dog because they've been domesticated. That's not your fault. You're caring for them. You're taking care of them. But, you know, the same way you would take care of a child or a baby. You know, a baby might not want to have a bath, but you have to give a baby a bath. Your dog might not want to have a bath, but you have to give her a bath. That's a lot different than, you know, what I used to do with the dog I had when I'd make her, you know, sit with a cookie on her nose.
Yeah, I get
that's a big difference.
That one I get, like putting a cookie on her nose. That's
even, you know, sit and shake a paw. We're making them do that. There's no benefit to them to do that.
Well, there's where I disagree.
Doing
Hold
that,
on.
The only reason they're doing that is for us.
No, but we live in a society where we can't just let the dog jump all over other people and go wherever he or she wants to go. There has to be discipline, right? There has to be sit, stay. There is a car coming down the street, and for your own benefit and for the benefit of others.
Well, that's the difference.
Well, right. And so I just mean
it's
that
for when it's for their safety, that's one thing.
Correct.
But if you're making them, you know, make them shake a paw because it's cute, it's got nothing to do with what they want and what they need and what they require out of life. It's just simply because I want to show somebody how cute this is.
I agree with you on shaking a paw.
It's such a human thing
anyway.
I get it. If you have to put a dog on a leash, you know, in most places that you live, in most places it's even the law.
Yeah.
And to walk them across the street, yeah, you want them to be safe. You don't want them running all over the place. So they're, you know, I get it. Yeah, maybe there's a bit of a fine line there. But is it for their own good or is it for your own good?
Right. And I think that's the question that we should ask, and we can figure out what's right and wrong based on the answer to that question. So yeah, I would say shaking a paw, totally unnecessary, whereas sit and stay is necessary. But again, that's me. I don't know how.
I think it's bad. If you're your traffic example, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I was definitely acting as devil's advocate more so just to see what the answers would be. So I'm not saying like I totally disagree with some of those concepts at all. I just think that it gets hard, and we really need to sit down and think about this stuff, because no one is thinking about it. Generally speaking,
no,
we're not thinking about these issues and our relationship to animals. We just think that they're here and we can use them for whatever we want. And so we become intellectually lazy and we just go about our day.
Yeah. And I think, well, all we need to think about is why do they have to do this? And is it for their benefit or for mine? And really, maybe it's not completely black and white, but I don't think it is really that complicated. Who is benefiting from this action, and why do they have to do it?
Yeah.
It both boils down to that.
Cool. All right.
I agree with 100% of everything she said. When it comes to, even it comes to like support animals. Like it's why, whatever. That's a whole nother discussion. But if I'm using someone for my benefit, even if it makes my life a little easier, I'm using someone.
Yeah. I get that. And exploitation is always going to be inherently wrong to whatever degree. I think there are degrees of wrongness and degrees of exploitation.
Yeah. And I will use the word wrong.
Yeah, I think my
doesn't like saying right or wrong, but I'll say it.
I think my reluctance to probably embrace everything that's been said is it comes from effectiveness, maybe, that like I just can't see spreading a message. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe like this is the most consistent, because it is consistent message we should be saying in terms of being effective to the non-vegan community.
Yeah, but nobody's also saying that you have to go to do demonstrations about not making your dog sit and shake a paw.
Right. That's where
you can still accept that is not ethically consistent.
Wait, Ben,
but
wait.
You know, that's not the hill you're going to die on, kind of thing, right?
All right, never mind. I was going to come up with some hypothetical example where we start a protest. No, I think, right, because our time and resources are limited, I personally, and this is just me as an individual activist, I like to focus on the 99% of suffering out there, which is farms, you know, the farming,
sure,
of animals.
And if that's where your activism goes, then that's fantastic. It still doesn't mean we can't discuss it or talk about it or even take a stance on it if it comes up.
Sure.
But yeah, you don't have to start a demonstration on and shake a paw.
Right. Okay. I don't know why that was making me laugh. I'm sorry. All right. Let's move on to the news.
All right, big news in Canada, in Abbotsford, BC on the weekend. Did you see what happened?
I did. It came up on my news feed and I was really surprised. I know this has happened many times. I don't know about many times, but at least a few times before in the past in other countries.
I know this is the first time in Canada. Israel, and I know it's happened in Australia.
Okay, so is this number three?
There may be others. Those are just the two that I remember in the last, I'd say, you know, the Israel one, I think, was only like a year or so ago. And then there's been a couple in Australia. But yeah, no, this was, it was pretty cool. So what was it? 65 activists entered a factory farm in Abbotsford, BC. 135 activists were standing outside. So they got over 200 people together to do this. Our friends Dan and Sean Moskaluk were among the people that were there. Dan, the retired RCMP officer, who actually has the Vancouver Sun wrote an awesome piece about him, but we can talk about that another time. But the big thing about this is this has got mainstream coverage. So it's on, I'm looking at one right now, it's an article from CBC News.
Yeah,
that's our national news.
Awesome. In terms of that,
they're covering this, and but it even says on this one, it was dozens of activists peacefully demonstrated inside and outside Excelsior Hog Farm.
Okay, let's talk about what happened exactly. Do you know?
Yeah, so 65 of them basically stormed this farm, and I think I want to say 45 of them got in, maybe. And then I guess around back, the another group didn't get in, and they were blocked, I think, by the farmers that were there. So they went in, they took footage, they saw everything that happened and documented it all. It's now all over the news because they did this, and their footage is all over the news. And then at the end of the day, a bunch of them were charged with trespassing. And according to this article, only one person was charged with breaking and entering. So one person has is the possibility of criminal charges, and everyone else, I think, is trespassing. As far as this article, I'm not sure how that stands today.
I'm sure all of those people who went on the property are going to get charged for something.
Well, trespassing is one. Trespassing is a minor fine. It's not a big deal. There's no criminal record. There's nothing. Breaking and entering is actually a criminal offense.
Right.
So there is a huge difference.
They didn't break down any doors, right? They just walked in an open door.
I think they had to go through a break through a door. But as we found out with our friend Malcolm, who was charged with going onto fur farms, that if you go into a building that has farmed animals in it, that this is the loophole in Canadian law. Whether you break something or not, it's actually breaking and entering. But if there's no animals in that barn, it's just trespassing. Isn't that ridiculous?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you can tell who makes the laws or who has the power to shape the laws, at least. And speaking to that point, I know Camille Labchuk just wrote on her Facebook wall, and she's part of Animal Justice, for those who don't know, which is an organization in Canada which follows the law very closely here, that the Canadian fur industry here in Canada wants to make actions like this qualify as terrorism, which is really scary. And I guess
what does that mean then?
I think just,
so what's the difference? So it's not breaking and entering. It's what you get to go to jail for 15 years for terrorism.
I think the fines or the punishment would just be much, much heavier. Probably not even fines, right? At that point, it would just be, I don't know, jail time? I don't know. And I don't think they even have a clue yet. They're just making a general statement that they want to push some legislation forward with that in mind to try to outlaw what is being done by all these animal rights activists, because I guess it's having an effect.
But why would they get special treatment? Why should it be any different from them from if you're a shoe factory? Right, what if I break into a shoe factory and start filming people? Is that terrorism?
I guess for them to be consistent, they would have to say so.
Yes, exactly. Otherwise, it's just this special treatment that, and I know like there's a few states that have done it, right? That they have their egg gag laws. But it's a completely inconsistent and I would argue unconstitutional law. I can't see it. I can't see that passing in Canada.
Well, I really hope not, because they have passed those kinds of laws, and we've talked about it before on the show many times. I think there are, I want to say, 6 or 7 states that I know of in the USA that have laws like that, and I don't know if they call them terrorism, but like you just can't go in and take pictures. You can't even take pictures of the outside of the facilities in at least Iowa and other states, I'm sure.
That's so backwards and unconstitutional.
Oh, it's so bad. It's such a violation, of our constitutional rights. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We should know, putting aside the whole animal welfare, animal rights issue, we should be able to know where our food comes from. You know, let's just look at it from that perspective. Like, you're going to produce food for the mainstream society and then say no one's allowed to see how it's being produced?
Yeah.
It seems pretty ridiculous.
It is.
They've even gone so far to say possession of a picture is against the law, not just taking it. So, like, if I take it and then I send it to you, Ben, you would get charged just for, even though you didn't take the picture.
I can't see how that could hold up in a court.
Well, it's a crazy battle that's going on right now.
I can't see how that would possibly hold up in any court other than in some like crazy dictatorship. So, but anyway, so these, you know, over 200 activists in Abbotsford, BC. Awesome. Good job. That's we don't get coverage like this, mainstream coverage, that often. So this was pretty exciting to see. And this, it's when we get creative. Well, maybe this isn't creative, but when we get bold and brave and are able to conduct actions like this, this is when people take notice. So yeah. Great job.
I'm just going to qualify by saying I personally am not advocating for anyone to break the law. I don't know if you want to qualify.
I'm okay with it. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Okay. Yeah. From our position of hosting a podcast.
Am I going to get a call now and be like,
I don't know.
Ben said.
I assume the FBI is watching us already.
Oh, we know that. We've had that discussion.
Yeah. So no, I'm my personal approach is to do whatever it takes, but always stay within the boundaries of the law. That's just my own personal approach. Other people,
something's legal doesn't mean it's ethical.
That's right. But I like to play the game by whatever the rules are.
Who else broke the law? Rosa Parks.
Oh man, you could name so many people. Socrates, Jesus Christ.
Oh wow. Just saying.
Yeah, there were a lot of examples.
Okay.
Let's move on. No, I personally don't do that. That's all. And don't advocate for it. All right. So let's, what else do you want to talk about? Anything else?
No, let's move on to our excuse.
Okay. Let's go.
So you ready? So, Kevin, who are you to decide what is right or wrong?
Oh my God.
When did you become the moral police? Who made you God?
Directly relevant to our discussion today. Right and wrong.
It's funny how often that works out because I never plan it that way.
Oh no, you had this before. Okay, I gotcha.
No, I never plan an excuse to fit like an episode topic, but
that's what I mean.
Often happens that way.
Yeah, you picked it before you knew that we were gonna have a discussion about right and wrong. Okay. So to me that's the same as saying morality is subjective. It's the same as saying that each individual defines his or her rightness and wrongness. And actually, that's exactly what she said. She mentioned that morality is subjective. So I definitely disagree with that, but, and for good reasons. You know, Hitler's, I always hate using Hitler, but his own personal subjective reality does not make right and wrong based on what he thinks, or an animal abuser doesn't get to define rightness and wrongness based on what he or she thinks. You don't create right and wrong as an individual. We collectively don't create right and wrong. I'll go further. I believe that we discover moral laws of the universe just as we discover scientific laws of the universe, the theory of relativity, law of gravity, all these scientific principles that we are bound by. We are also discovering through our tools of reasoning and being rational, these laws of morality. And so there is an objective morality that we have to figure out. We're not creating. It's a big difference. It's discovering rather than creating. And so when it comes to animals, we are discovering how sentient they are. For example, you know, I say thousands of years ago, we didn't know how sentient they were, how aware they were, how capable they were of feeling pain. But now we know, we've discovered all that. And that is directly relevant to the way that we treat them and our obligation to them changes based on that fact. So yeah, I guess I just completely disagree and say that's not true.
I like that. That's one of my favorite responses you've given. That was good. No, I like that. Yeah, you said that, you know, it's beyond us. It's not just, you know, what we decide, even as a collective, that there are these laws that we're bound by. And I think it's kind of arrogant to say that, you know, morality is subjective. Although I guess this is the same excuse, basically just worded in a different way. But you're right that it's kind of arrogant to say that humanity gets to define it, because it is beyond us. And yeah, I like to use individual. The word rational, because it is rational to think that it's wrong to use someone for your own good or for your own pleasure or for anything other than survival.
Totally. I'd say just as a scientist has instruments like a microscope or, you know, a telescope, whatever he or she uses to discover things, we have our tools of logic and reason and being rational. So like those are our tools in the toolbox, and that's how we discover these moral laws.
And even when it seems like the world is becoming more and more irrational every day, we can still stick to logic. You're right. That is our tool. Not even. I see in our movement, I see the irrational. And I mean, I just want to qualify. The term irrational doesn't mean, you know, everything you're doing is wrong and ridiculous. It just means that it's not objective. It means that you're basing it on an emotional response rather than objectively looking at the big picture and coming to a logical conclusion. But a lot of things are irrational. Not everything that is irrational means that it's wrong, but there's too much of it, because we can simplify things by just making them logical.
You are definitely right about things being, I can give you an example. If you want to know an example, I sweep the floor first and then I wipe down the table and all the crumbs fall onto the floor. Like, God damn it. What? So that's irrational, but immoral.
But you have a dog roommate, so the dog can just yeah. eat up the crumbs, right? Does she do that?
If they're big enough, oftentimes they're not big enough, and then they'll just...
I remember after my dog Jessie died that, I mean, obviously I missed her immensely, but then I realized how much cleaning up she did, because, like, holy shit, there's crumbs everywhere, and there was never crumbs before.
Yeah, it certainly helps. I guess that's part of the... but that's not why you have a dog.
No.
I was going to say symbiotic relationship. But if you had the dog simply for that reason, it would be not okay.
As a vacuum.
Right. It's an added benefit, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess we're good. Anything else you want to say?
No, I don't have an end rant or anything today.
Nothing bothering you these days?
Oh, there's a lot bothering me.
All right. Forget I asked that question. Okay. Thank you guys for listening. Please check us out on patreon.com/ The Live Vegan Podcast and on Facebook and Instagram, The Live Vegan Podcast, or share one of our episodes, tell one of your friends about it. And don't forget to subscribe. Ben, as always,
live vegan.
Thank you for listening to The Live Vegan Podcast.